This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
There's been a growing problem in the healthcare system that hasn't gotten much attention, but little by little has been affecting patient care and changing the way some doctors practice. It's the shortage of drugs, not experimental exotic new meds, but everyday, reliable medications that doctors have used for years.
89% of the hospitals said they're experiencing drug shortage. 80% say that the shortage results in a delay or cancellation of patient care.
On today's Health Show, we'll look into the causes, effects, and possible solutions of this problem.
Then we'll look into another shortage that, while not life-threatening, certainly made life different in post-Katrina New Orleans. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. Last October, President Obama issued an executive order giving the Food and Drug Administration increased power to try and put an end to the growing shortage of some drugs in the United States. A survey from the Institute for Safe Medication Practices in November found that 25% of physicians said an error had occurred because of drug shortages. Here to talk about this serious healthcare problem is Dr. David Kyle, Director of Continuing Education and Professional Development at Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences in Albany, New York.
You know, Doctor, drug shortages, I know that they've existed, and I know that they've been a problem for years, but over the past perhaps year or two, I have heard more about drug shortages. They have affected my patients, and I was very anxious to get more information about why this problem is occurring, and especially perhaps how we can fix it if it's possible.
Well, to talk about the numbers, over the last 5 years, drug shortages have actually tripled. You know, last year they said there were 267 reported drug shortages, according to the FDA. You know, you go back to 2006, we're talking there was only 70 at that point in time. So obviously the impact is there because the numbers are increasing. And the situation of why they're occurring, you know, there's particular categories of medications. Over 80% of the medications that are in short supply are sterile injectable products. Over 80%, again, are generic products. So they're low-cost products that are available only from a limited number of suppliers. There may only be a few suppliers of some of these products. They say the total of generic injectables market, half are on the shortages list. And this has impacted patients primarily in hospitals and in outpatient facilities where they do outpatient procedures with these injectable drugs.
Such as what I might use to do colonoscopies.
Exactly.
So for conscious sedation,
exactly.
Which is how we're seeing that.
Yep.
Or pain medication for postoperative patients, that kind of thing.
Exactly. IMS, which is a provider of information services and technology on the healthcare industry, they did an analysis last October, and they said 56 of the drugs that are on the shortages list at that time were only made by one supplier. So if something affects the one and only supplier, we're in trouble immediately. And there's certain drug classes that are primarily affected. Oncology and cancer drugs are at the top of the list. Anti-infectives, antibiotics, antifungals are at the top of the list. Cardiovascular drugs. And as you said, drugs in the CNS and pain management category, they account for about 20% of the total from that analysis in October.
Would it be too simplistic to say, well, it's just because these are cheap generic drugs and there's no money in them, so they're stopping making them?
That's part of the reason of why there is a shortage. These companies look at their return on investment in producing these products. You can make a vial of propofol and sell it for 50 cents. Can you really make any money doing that? So sometimes it's a financial decision on the part of these companies. If you talk to the Food and Drug Administration, they say a lot of the top issue is usually a manufacturing issue, maybe contamination, maybe particulates in a sterile injectable product. Now, the University of Utah Drug Information Service, they have a great service that they provide to the American Society of Health Systems Pharmacists and maintain a website. Now, when they investigated what's going on, 54% of the time the manufacturers told them the reason was unknown. And this was in 2011. So, you know, it's kind of like exactly what is going on. There's delays and capacity issues. Certain times the company discontinues the product. Other times there may be an issue where they can't get the raw materials.
So it isn't price gouging.
That happens with the gray market. Now, the gray market is kind of a supply channel that's somewhat unofficial, maybe unauthorized, not necessarily intended by the original manufacturer. Everybody's probably familiar with the black market. Well, the gray market has a little bit more legitimacy to it. But what happens there is hospitals frequently get calls from gray market vendors. And believe it or not, 56% of hospitals surveyed by the Institute for Safe Medication Practices got a daily solicitation by these gray market vendors. What's interesting is 52% of these hospitals actually bought one or more products in the last 2 years. And 80% of these hospitals says they've increased their purchasing over the last 2 years. They're forced almost to have to go to these gray market vendors who mark up the price dramatically.
It sounds like ticket scalping. It's like StubHub for drugs.
It is. It is. The Premier Purchasing Partners is a group purchasing organization. They surveyed about 220 hospitals in 2010. 89% of the hospitals said they're experiencing drug shortage. 80% say that the shortage results in a delay or cancellation of patient care. And 98% experienced shortages that resulted in an increased cost. Now, when they analyzed that, they said the average markup was 650% above the normal contract price. So you're right, it's like ticket scalping. It's what the market will bear.
Is there a solution?
Well, let's talk about what is the FDA doing currently. In fact, President Obama signed an executive order on October 31st of last year, and the directives in that were to reduce and prevent drug shortages, protect consumers, prevent stockpiling, and also to prevent exorbitant pricing. So the FDA kicked into action after that. They sent out a letter, and they reminded manufacturers that if you make a life-sustaining or life-supporting drug, they're mandated by law to report that to the FDA. So that did have an effect. The FDA said they previously would get maybe 10 notifications a month from the pharmaceutical industry that a drug is going to be in short supply. They said within a short period of time after issuing that letter, that number jumped up to about 61 reports per month. Now, what else can the FDA do? There's actually been congressional hearings to propose and approve legislation, but unfortunately, Congress is not really moving fast on those. There's actually three different pieces of legislation that are out there. There's also having congressional hearings. You know, why is there price gouging? Why is there stockpiling? Why is there hoarding? That sort of thing. What the FDA is doing now is to encourage other manufacturers in the U.S. to ramp up production. They also provide some kind of regulatory enforcement discretion if it's a minor production violation at a facility. Rather than shut down their production line, they'll work with the company to try and resolve the issue rather than stop production completely. They may also approve new manufacturers or new applications to produce some of these drugs that are in short supply. There's even consideration of extending the expiration dating on drug. A drug that expires on the first of this month, could I use it until the last day of the month? You know, and that's a possibility. They can encourage manufacturers to increase production capacity, but these manufacturers, they're usually working in older facilities. They do have to take production lines down to get them in shape to produce a new drug on that line, and they have a certain production schedule or production quota that they have to follow. Now, the FDA can also approve new sources of raw materials. You know, unfortunately, the majority of the active pharmaceutical ingredients for drugs in the U.S. come from foreign countries. So it's a matter of, do they have the manpower to inspect those sources of supply? And they can also change production specifications slightly to kind of ease the requirements for producing these products. Now, what they've done recently, there's been two major shortages. One is preservative-free methotrexate, which is used for pediatric leukemias and used in high dose in children for osteogenic sarcoma.
Yeah.
You can't use a preservative product. The U.S. supplies were pretty much wiped out. So what the Food and Drug did is authorize a new U.S. manufacturer and worked with the remaining manufacturer to increase their production capabilities. So there's one cancer drug that was, you saw a lot of human interest stories. You know, the
yes.
mother of the child saying, I went to the oncology clinic, my child couldn't get the drug that they got the last time they were here. Other cancer drugs, there's a liposomal doxorubicin, which is a fancy form of doxorubicin. The FDA recently approved a manufacturer in India, so temporarily we'll be allowed to import that drug from a foreign country.
Well, that is a question I wanted to ask. There was a lot of talk about that a few years ago, about trying to lower costs by importing drugs from other countries, mainly Canada. Is this something that might help it, or are we just shuffling around the same supply?
Well, one side of the coin says, can we trust sources of supply from foreign countries? Now, the Poor Food and Drug Administration can't catch a break. There were some death row inmates that recently got a U.S. judge to prevent the FDA from authorizing the importation of a drug that's used for
the lethal injections.
Lethal injections. So the FDA is trying to do a right thing on one side, and they're getting legal actions against them when they try to import a drug that's used in anesthesia, yes, in addition to lethal injections.
Still to come, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Kyle and talk about how the shortage of drugs is changing the way some doctors practice. That's next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a tape or CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1255.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Our guest today is Dr. David Kyle, Director of Continuing Education and Professional Development at Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences in Albany, New York. And before we get back to you, Dr. Kyle, I want to ask you, Nina, how this is affecting you and perhaps some of your colleagues in their practices. Do you need to do a lot of juggling and, you know, we'll do this because we can't do that?
It's happening. Particularly, we were talking about these injectable medicines. So when you do procedures such as colonoscopy and endoscopy, you do what's called conscious sedation. And so we had used quite a bit of a medication called fentanyl, and now we cannot get fentanyl. That was one of our primary medications. Fortunately, we've been able to substitute another medication called Demerol, which we used to use. So yes, we have been juggling. But in this case, we still have been able to plan and do our procedures effectively. But certainly if you have a child with leukemia, you know, that's a different issue. Or cancer, and you've gone through treatment and suddenly you can't get treated. That's an even, to me, a more serious issue. I also have colleagues who work in the intensive care units at hospitals who are not able to get certain medications to support blood pressure in patients that are critically ill. So every day it might be something different. They may be juggling and using a different medication. Well, we're pretty resourceful and we understand these things, but it just seems that every day is a challenge for things that aren't really critical to patient care. How to take care of the patient, but these are new challenges that we're just not used to in this country. And then I wonder, can I do anything? Can we physicians do anything as a group? And that's kind of why I'm glad to be here discussing this.
Are there things that physicians themselves can do, or is this just something that's above their pay grade?
Well, I've been in health systems, hospital and health system pharmacy for 35 years, 25 years as director. You know, drug shortages used to be a nuisance. Now it's almost a daily crisis. When you call a practitioner such as you, Dr. Sachs, and say, "Doctor, we don't have that drug that you routinely use," the doctor's typical response is, "Well, get it. I don't care where you get it from. Just get it, because that's what I'm used to using." If I ask a practitioner to use a therapeutic alternative, they may not be familiar with it. That then puts patients at risk for a medication error. And there have been documented medication errors when you couldn't get the primary drug in supply, you used a secondary drug, the nurse, the pharmacist, the physician may not have been up to speed on that alternative drug, and medication errors do occur.
From your experience, do you see this as something that the marketplace just isn't going to be able to take care of itself, and perhaps government action might have to come?
I think government action is going to be necessary. And even when that occurs, I think we're going to see this go on for another 3 to 5 years. And the financial impact is huge. You know, the Premier Purchasing Partners figures that just the higher cost of drugs is greater than $200 million a year. The American Society of Health Systems Pharmacists surveyed hospitals across the country. Those hospitals figured just the labor cost involved, and I use the term scrambling to get a needed drug or an alternative drug, that figure is $216 million a year. Mm-hmm. So these costs are increasing, not only for the drug, but also the time and effort and resources to obtain alternative products.
I know that our society, American Society of GI Endoscopy, is trying to figure out ways to get the government more involved mm-hmm. and to at least make them aware of what's going on. And that's only one small society. So I am sure that many societies, medical societies, are trying to make our government understand the impact of shortages.
Well, it's gotten a lot more publicity, and you can see from a presidential proclamation a lot of pressure is being put on. Is it as simple as just telling that drug company that can produce that 50-cent batch of drugs will charge $10 for it then?
Well, that's part of the issue. In our society, cheaper is what everyone's looking for, whether it's a new car or a generic medication. Maybe we've underpriced all these. In a lot of other countries, the government sets the rates of how drugs are charged.
Right, because it seems like we're going through the law of unintended consequences. You know, we want to go to generics, generics are cheaper, but there's other issues. And I think that's, to me, what we're seeing now.
Yeah, the pharmaceutical companies don't have the incentive to sell products at a very low price if they're not making any money.
So where do we go from here?
Well, again, yeah, I think the FDA needs the regulatory authority to step things up. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be critical of the Food and Drug Administration. They actually have a drug shortage program. But believe it or not, several years ago, there were only 3 people involved in that program. They have increased that number now to 5. However, they do admit that they pull in at least a couple dozen other people from the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research to assist them now with handling drug shortages. But they need the authority. They'll also need the resources to be able to step up their actions.
Then what? What do you see long term happening?
Well,
speculate for us.
Well, you know, here's where you get into, you know, should the government be buying all the drugs? Now, we stockpile flu vaccines several years ago. Does it make sense for the government to stockpile oncology drugs that may be in short supply? I'm not so sure if that's the right answer either. One other problem, again, that gray market is problematic. You know, they actually reach out to hospitals and say, do you have any extra stock? Can I buy what you've got? They reach out to infusion centers or home care companies. So there needs to be more regulations governing this gray market. You mm-hmm. know, they're the ones who are taking advantage of a situation and making money on it. There are actually legitimate pharmacies owned by an individual who buy the drugs legitimately from a prime vendor wholesaler. They then set up under their own name a wholesale operation of their own. So the pharmacy that they own sells it to the wholesaler that they own, who marks up the price and sells it to other pharmacies. So there have been some recent press reports that they've nabbed a few unscrupulous individuals who are, again, taking advantage of this situation.
And to use the analogy we used before, if that happens to concert tickets, who really cares? This is important.
This is important. It really is.
Then you get into the ethical issues. You know, if we're allocating a product that's in short supply, are we rationing care? You know, that's thrown out there. You know, do I give it to this pediatric patient or to that pediatric patient if I only have so much drug? Then again, the whole issue of, is it appropriate to even buy from the gray market? Out of necessity, people are doing it. And then the natural tendency for any pharmacy is to kind of hoard or stockpile medications. You know, we would frequently borrow back and forth from hospital to hospital. Nowadays, when you call, they'll say, no, I've got some, but I can't let you have any because we're not sure if we can get any more ourselves.
Dr. David Kyle is the Director of Continuing Education and Professional Development at Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences in Albany, New York. Losing all the best recipes may not be as devastating as running out of life-saving medications, but it certainly made an impact in New Orleans. The city is a food-loving town where treasured recipes are handed down for generations. After Katrina, you could see floodwater-soaked recipe cards pinned on clotheslines to dry. While many recipes and cookbooks couldn't be saved, the World Vision Report's Mary Stuckey reports not all were lost forever.
Shannon Jones is in the kitchen chopping celery for the chicken and sausage gumbo that's bubbling on her stove.
What we're doing is we're starting to saute the vegetables, the trinity. What we call the trinity is celery, bell peppers, and onions.
Jones loves her new house, rebuilt on exactly the same spot as her old house, which was destroyed when the levees broke. When the floodwaters receded, she tried to rescue her recipes, but all was lost.
It was the first thing I thought about was my cookbooks, my own personal notes. I took notes while I was being taught to cook this gumbo. It took me years to remember that I was supposed to be putting liquid smoke in it.
Losing their recipes was one big part of the disaster. Here, food is life.
We go out to lunch and sit around in restaurants at lunchtime discussing where we're going to go out to dinner. When my son and I go on vacation, he always says, "That was fun when we're getting on the plane to come home. Now let's go home and eat."
That's New Orleans, says Judy Walker, food editor at the Times-Picayune newspaper. Almost immediately after Katrina, Walker began getting requests for recipes destroyed in the flood. When she couldn't find a recipe herself, she put a notice in the newspaper.
I had two people ask me for the exact same recipe on the same day for that sweet potato corn and jalapeno bisque. You know, things kept happening like that.
So while the city was being rebuilt, Walker engaged in her own reconstruction project. She began collecting recipes unique to this melting pot of Creole, Cajun, Italian, African, French, and German cuisine. The cookbook she eventually co-authored, called Cooking Up a Storm, was published 2 years ago.
I realized that this project wouldn't have been needed had this horrible disaster happened elsewhere. But in New Orleans, because we specifically have this culture of food, because we have these specific ingredients, we needed our recipes back. You know, The Joy of Cooking is a wonderful cookbook. Doesn't have a lot of crawfish recipes in it.
In Walker's cookbook, there's crawfish and corn chowder, crawfish in saffron sauce, crawfish pie, even Jerry's crawfish bread.
We have always had a huge number of desserts and sweets based on cane sugar. Of course, we have the famous pralines. They're very sweet. They're very good. I cannot resist them.
And you say praline, not praline.
Oh, no, not praline. It's a praline here. And it's crawfish, not crayfish.
And it's roux, a mix of fat and flour, an important ingredient in gumbo. Shannon Jones toasts her roux to a deep chocolate color, stirring for nearly an hour. Gumbo is one of the first things Jones made after Katrina. It was a source of comfort to her and the friends who sheltered her after the storm.
So many of us needed a place to just kind of gather. People were either living in tiny apartments or commuting from Baton Rouge or living in trailers. And we had these dinner parties every single Wednesday.
Now, more than 5 years later, they're still gathering every week to cook and eat together in each other's homes. The hurricane and floodwaters may have destroyed their homes and leveled their communities, but these Louisianans are determined to make sure it didn't wipe out their culture. I'm Mary Stuckey in New Orleans.
That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.